2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 261, The Church and Its Scholars, 10 Years Later, a paper presented by Levina Fielding Anderson, with a response by Armand L. Moss.
Sheridan, we're considerably higher than saying them on the other side of the continent. Neither one of us was sure, but we were sure enough. How many of you were present at that Sunstone 10 years ago? Well, good. It was a plenary session, as I recall, and it was in the Seasons Ballroom around the corner where we would have all fit more comfortably than... Feel free to keep coming up and sitting on the floor. The title on the program was Dialogue Toward Forgiveness, a Chronology of the Intellectual Community and Church Leadership. The published version did not use the main title, Dialogue Toward Forgiveness, but it was important in my presentation because it captured the tone I hoped to convey and the reason I was delivering the paper in the first place. My introduction to that paper said, and I think it's pretty amazing that I still subscribe to every word, this presentation is a chronology of events that I consider significant in establishing the record of the frequently tense relationship during the past 15 years or so between the institutional church and two overlapping sub-communities, intellectuals and women. I believe there is no question that the institutional church sees these two constituencies as troublesome. If I were doing this now, I would add gays and lesbians to this list. But I would characterize members of both as friendly critics. They occupy a sometimes uneasy middle ground between the unfriendly critics of Mormonism on the one hand and the uncritical friendlies within the church on the other, who proclaim, "My church, right or wrong, but it's never wrong." Differences between scholars, feminists, and ecclesiastical leaders have been negotiated in various ways, sometimes mutually respectful, sometimes harsh and punitive. This is a chronology, not yet an analysis. One reason is that the sheer facts of what happened need to be determined before a responsible analysis can be made. For another reason, I approach this topic as a woman interested in relationships. I am less interested in the various positions defended and attacked about, say, the New Mormon history, than I am about what such attacks and defenses do to our community and the human costs in pain, mistrust, and violations of agency. The relationship between Mormon intellectuals and feminists and their church is a troubled and painful relationship, and I hope to see steps taken toward reconciliation. So why am I committing such a potentially disruptive act? Still quoting, I am doing it because I feel that I must. After the Council of the First Presidency and 12 Statement opposing symposia, I spent the fall and the winter making this decision. I carefully reread the Book of Mormon, paying particular attention to passages about pride, rebelliousness, and disobedience. I pondered my patriarchal blessing, which four times enjoins me to humility. I prayed, fasted, went to the temple, performed my callings with new exactness, and was newly attentive in meetings. I was looking for reasons not to write this paper. Earlier, I had prayed to know my responsibility in the Vietnam War, about priesthood for blacks, about the IWI conference, and the Equal Rights Amendment. In each case, I received a clear answer, this is not your cause. This winter, this is the winter of 1992, on this issue I received a different answer. I say this not to play spiritual giant games, but to tell you that I am trying to be as responsible as I know how to be. I stand before you as a witness in the household of faith. I am not an accuser. I am not a judge. I know that the record is incomplete. I know that there are parts I do not understand. I know that many of the victims of ecclesiastical harassment have not been totally innocent of provocative actions. Furthermore, I know that the record is lopsided. Since I have gathered these reports from members, not from the leaders, they inevitably reflect the perspectives of members, nor am I free from personal sympathy in my reporting of them. There is no way at this stage to make allowances for the fact that a bishop or a general authority would probably tell a different story, that the member's shock and hurt overlay memories of the experience, or that the member may minimize in retelling or may still be genuinely unaware of the extent to which his or her behavior may have been interpreted or misinterpreted as provocative, defiant, and deviant. I do not speculate on the motives of members involved in the cases reported here. Some of these motives may have been unworthy, but I do not speculate on the motives of their ecclesiastical leaders either, and some of those motives may also have been unworthy. Despite the lopsidedness, I insist that such a record is worth creating and maintaining. It is driven by the search for knowledge. We must not deny that such things exist nor that they are wrong. Once we know what happened, then we can begin to understand it. With understanding comes forgiveness, and with forgiveness, then love can increase in our community. I want a more loving community, a more inclusive community, a more forgiving community. For example, the disclosure that Elder Paul Dunn had fabricated some of his military and baseball stories and his explanations that they were just parables made me physically nauseated. I felt personally betrayed and exploited. But when I read Elder Dunn's apology in the church news soon after the helpful and balanced discussion of the issue in Sunstone, I forgave him with all my heart, willingly and fully. Thanks both to Sunstone and Elder Dunn, I feel that a breach in the community has been healed. Certainly one in my heart has been. I offer this paper as another step in the ongoing dialogue within our community with the hope of forgiveness, with the offer of forgiveness. That was the introduction. Then the chronology followed. When I was through and sat down, I was so emotionally exhausted that it took me a few seconds to catch up with myself. Irene Bates was sitting on the front row on the left-hand side. She jumped to her feet, applauding vigorously, and the rest of the audience followed. Eugene England was the first person to the rostrum during the question-answer period, and he added a piece to the chronology with a stirring j'accuse in the tradition of Émile Zola by denouncing the activities of a group I'd never heard of, the Strengthening Church Members Committee. Fernand Anderson, then bureau chief for the Associated Press, was sitting halfway back on the far right side, and about where Brent is now. Quietly, he stood up and walked out of the hall. At the end of the hour, Leonard Arrington rushed forward, and before I could come down the steps to meet him, seized my hand and kissed it. It was pretty obvious that the chronology had touched a community nerve. The next morning, the church's confirmation that the Strengthening Church Members Committee did exist to document the troublesome activities of members was on the AP wire. However, as measured by desired results, this paper was spectacularly unsuccessful. Cecilia Conchar Farr and David Knowlton were fired from BYU the next spring, followed by the forced withdrawal of Brian Evanson. Gail Houston and Steve Epperson were also fired. Gene England, Sam Rushforth, Scott Abbott, and Tim Slover moved from BYU down the street to Utah Valley State College. In addition to the disfellowshipping of Lynn Knavel Whitesides, the following individuals from the Mormon intellectual community were excommunicated: Abraham Gileadi, who has since been reinstated, me, Maxine Hanks, Paul Toscano, Michael Quinn, David Wright, who had earlier been fired from BYU and was then teaching at Brandeis, Brent Metcalf, Michael Barrett, and Steve Epperson. Janice Allred was excommunicated in time for Mother's Day, 1995. Margaret Toscano was excommunicated for Thanksgiving, 2000. Albert Peck, twice scheduled for excommunication, was spared by as yet undisclosed administrative processes, but not, I believe, because those administrators found him innocent. And since 1992, the level of authoritarianism in the church has increased dramatically. Here are some markers. In 1992, the Relief Society still had lessons of its own. They were written by anonymous committees, true, and quoted general authorities with ritualistic fervor, but sometimes they also quoted women and told stories about women. Now the Relief Society manual is the priesthood manual. The only voice we hear in our lessons is male, that of a church president. This leads to truly bizarre episodes in which the woman teacher can read a passage addressed to you brethren to a room full of sisters and no one raises an eyebrow. The visiting teaching messages, one page in the ensign, were focused on a theme that the Religious Society presidency had picked for the year and always included an inspirational anecdote about a woman in addition to instructions and appropriate scriptures. Now the visiting teaching message consists exclusively of quotations from the scriptures and general authorities and occasionally from a general auxiliary presidency. In 1992, the Ensign and New Era published a First Presidency's message as the lead article every month. The Friend did a monthly interview with the general authority, including the 70s, focused on the experiences of their childhood. The Ensign always published a conference issue twice a year. Earlier this year, a new format was imposed on the magazines. Out of 14 articles or features in the June Friend, 5 were by or about general authorities, and sidebar quotations by general authorities or general auxiliary leaders accompanied 2 more. I suspect that the percentage would have been higher, except that four features on temples also appeared in this issue. For the new era, 6 out of 13 articles were by or about general authorities, with 3 quotation sidebars. The July issue of the Ensign, out of 14 articles, excluding departments, had 5 by general authorities, 4 on the Nauvoo Temple, and 3 quotation sidebars. In short, there are fewer voices in official discourse, and they are increasingly male and increasingly authoritative. The follow the prophet drum roll has increased to a deafening decibel level. The apostles have been newly exalted as also prophets, seers, and revelators. Obedience to the prophet has been equated with obedience to God. Junior apostles in 70s have urged that obedience is even more valuable when it seems to make no sense and when the person being obeyed has no expertise in the subject upon which he is requiring obedience. A new piece of theology was articulated by Apostle David B. Haight when he redefined the law of common consent. When we sustain the president of the church by our uplifted hand, it not only signifies that we acknowledge before God that he is the rightful possessor of all the priesthood keys, it means that we covenant with God that we will abide by the direction and the counsel that come through his prophet. The proclamation on the family has likewise added a new piece of theology without benefit of canonization or discussion in its assertion that gender is eternal. This doctrinal claim provides a piece missing from the scriptures to support the church's wobbly position that homosexuality is always chosen and without a significant genetic component. The church has paid millions of dollars, both directly and indirectly, through mobilizing member contributions to political campaigns designed to pass legislation outlawing same-sex marriages that are already not legal. In the past 10 years, BYU devotional speakers, instead of talking about the equal importance of spiritual and intellectual learning, have so persistently privileged spiritual over intellectual learning that it has become something of a mantra. The church's well-documented tendency to deny, minimize, or suppress information about inappropriate ecclesiastical response to reported cases of child sexual abuse, while undeniably successful in a significant fraction of the cases, has resulted in payments of millions of dollars in damages as victims have successfully sued in Texas, Oregon, California, and West Virginia. So far, the church has not lost a suit in Utah. The church's response is still shockingly inadequate. There are still no lessons even on inappropriate touching, let alone on emotional, physical, and spiritual abuse in the child, youth, and women's curricula. I don't think there is in the men's either. There is still no helpline for victims, only a hotline for ecclesiastical leaders. The ritually invoked training that the church claims to give ward and stake leaders is, for the most part, confined to a single annual session for priesthood leaders. In our stake, the last session of which I am aware was given 3 years ago and focused not on helping victims, but on safeguarding the legal rights of the accused abuser. Not the least of the bitter harvest of the last decade is what has happened to some of the children of the purge, youngsters who have seen the church at its cruelest. By my count, the excommunicants have 41 children among them. I don't have information on the Gileadi children, but I know that 25 of the remaining 32, 78%, no longer affiliate with the church. To my knowledge, only 2 of the young men growing up in these families have served missions since 1993. The church, for all its pro-family rhetoric, has shown itself frighteningly willing to consider a generation of children as collateral damage. I feel immense gratitude that my son Christian, who has seen the church at its worst, was still able to look past some of this behavior and has chosen to live a life of allegiance. As he announced in his own Sunstone presentation at age 17, he planned to serve a mission, which he has done, and to marry in the temple, which he will do next month. I feel immense sorrow for those other children who have been forced into exile with their parents, who must necessarily see the church as endangering rather than enhancing their spiritual lives. I deeply resent the injustice that the church, rather than assuming its share of the responsibility for this situation, simply blames the parents. A friend of mine used to say, "Progress is when things are getting worse more slowly." I don't know if what we are experiencing is progress or not. I hope so. I ask Armin to be my respondent for this paper because I'm counting on him to add some balance. But from my perspective, it's not unrealistic to interpret the last 10 years as a litany of losses to individuals and losses to the community. It's only right to document that Gene England deeply regretted his denunciation of the Strengthening Church Members Committee. He apologized in a letter to Sunstone, personally to the two apostles who were then serving on the committee, and in his Provo residential ward on Fast Sunday in October 1992. Writer Scott Parkin, who attended his first Sunstone last year and admits that he quite enjoyed it, even though he's on what he calls the conservative end, was a member of Gene's ward. With his permission, I quote his account of that occasion. I happened to live in Gene's ward at the time. I had no idea of what had happened at Sunstone, and so had no idea what the context was when he stood up during gospel doctrine class and with a broken heart and contrite spirit apologized for any harm he had done in speaking his opinions. I'm sorry, I said it was Fast Sunday. It wasn't. It was a Sunday school class. He reiterated his faith and trust in the brethren and his commitment to the church and the gospel. Though I had no idea why he spoke those words, I felt that he spoke them from his heart and with extraordinary humility. I believed him, and I believe the Spirit bore witness of the truth of his words and his intent. That day, I gained a deep and abiding respect for Gene England as an honest seeker for truth, a respect that causes me to now read his words with a great deal more charity than I might once have had. Scott added that this experience is one reason why he is so grateful that Gene recorded his own story of this experience and why he, Scott, is such a strong believer in why we all need to tell our stories our way, because only by telling the story from all perspectives and viewpoints can we understand the impact and power of human experience to our benefit and detriment. I yield to none in my admiration of Gene's extraordinary spiritual sensitivity and willingness to look first in his own heart instead of accusing others. But I parted company with him on the conclusion that he drew, that because two apostles were involved, it was inappropriate to critique the action. Gene and I had several conversations on the topic. He failed to persuade me that behavior that would have been reprehensible if William O. Nelson was doing it as a freelance orthodoxy vigilante was not reprehensible if two apostles were doing it. I failed to persuade him of my position. I don't think that's very important. What is important is that we were having a dialogue and that forgiveness, if any was needed between us because of our differences, was woven into the very fabric of our discourse. I don't think we'll ever know in this life what caused Gene's lethal brain tumors, but I can't help wondering what might have happened if his treatment at BYU and before had been such that he did not spend a crucial year thinking it quite natural that he was depressed. I can't help wondering if, in fact, earlier diagnosis might have made it possible for him to still be with us. In August 1992, I ended my presentation with 7 proposals. It's not only amazing that I still subscribe fully to these 7 proposals, but it's terrifying that they are still so relevant. I said, first, we must speak up. We must stop keeping bad secrets for an abusive church. We must share our stories and our pain. When we feel isolated, judged, and rejected, it is very easy to give up, to allow ourselves to become marginalized, and to accept the devaluation as accurate. If we silence ourselves or allow others to silence us, we will deny the validity of our experience, undermine the foundations of authenticity in our personal spirituality, and impoverish our collective life as a faith community. During the 1970s and 80s, I was an observer and occasionally a co-worker as a handful of modern women scholars discovered Mormon women's history. They did it from the documents. No living tradition had survived of the spiritual gifts and powers of women, of how they saw themselves, of their vision for women of the church and the world. By failing to perpetuate the past as a living tradition, the women and men who were its guardians had erased it. I cannot tell you how this hurt me. I learned for myself that silence and self-censorship are terrible wrongs. Reducing the diversity of voices in a community to a single official voice erases us. We must join in the ongoing dialogue between individual and community out of necessity and also out of love. Second, we must label what happens as accurately as we can. I pay my church the compliment of thinking that it espouses the ideals of justice and fairness. I am confused when leaders confiscate temple recommends of members who publicly praise the church's actions. In 1991, you'll remember, Ross Peterson, Keith Norman, Albert, and Daniel Rector all had their temple recommends taken away. Blacklists, secret files, and intimidation violate my American sense of fair play and my legal expectation of due process. They violate the academic ideal that truth is best served by an open interchange, that disagreement can be both courteous and clarifying, and that differences are not automatically dangerous. Most importantly, I am dismayed when the organization that teaches me to honor the truth and to act with integrity seems to violate those very principles in its behavior. I am bewildered and grieved when my church talks honorably from one script and acts ignobly from another. Some of the incidents I have mentioned have made me cry out with James, "My brethren, these things ought not so to be. I say they are wrong. I say they must change." Third, we must defend each other. Although some intellectuals and feminists are bitter, those I know personally are not trying to undermine the faith of others, do not hate the church, and are not cynical about their personal faith. To the extent that there is anti-intellectualism and anti-feminism in the church's response, it is unfair. Also unfair are any malice and irresponsibility in the activities of intellectuals and feminists. We need to provide honest feedback to each other, express caring and concern for each other. If I'm saying excessive, irresponsible things, I need to know it, and I'll hear it most clearly from my friends. We must sustain and support individuals who are experiencing ecclesiastical harassment. Such support will help prevent overreactions and speed the healing process in the survivor. Supportive observers may also help prevent some ecclesiastical abuse. Fourth, we must protest, expose, and work against an internal espionage system that creates and maintains secret files on members of the church. If there were some attempt to maintain a full and complete record, including the record of church service, the lives influenced for good, and the individual's spiritual strength, I might feel differently. I might also feel differently if individuals had access to their files. But they are secretly maintained and seem to be exclusively accusatory in their content. I find such an activity unworthy in every way of the Church of Jesus Christ. Fifth, we must be more proactive in dealing with our leaders based on our personal relationships with them. I have had good experiences with my stake president. He was released within a few months, and it was his replacement who excommunicated me. But I am repelled by reports of puppet interviews where a stake president or bishop is ordered to interview and or punish a member on information secretly supplied by ecclesiastical superiors. Such a procedure does not uphold the ideal of confidentiality. Rather, it violates the trust that should exist between member and leader, and we should say so. Furthermore, the stake president, not the offended general authority, is required to deal with the offender. This process short-circuits the scriptural injunction of face-to-face confrontation, including rebuking betimes with sharpness and then showing forth afterwards an increase of love. And finally, such a system isolates and insulates leaders from members. These leaders create hostile stereotypes of members who are evil and deserve to be punished and excluded. Similarly, members judge and stereotype faceless and voiceless general authorities who are known to them only through punitive intermediaries. Both behaviors are equally damaging. Sixth, we need to support, encourage, and sustain ecclesiastical leaders who also value honesty, integrity, and nurturing. In 1992, David Knowlton moved a large audience at Sunstone by describing how, after repeated embracing encounters with his stake president, his bishop listened, asked him how he felt, and gave him a blessing. David said he could not stop weeping during this interview, which did much to heal his wounds. When Garth Jones in Anchorage, Alaska, used a Bible translation other than the King James Version in his Sunday school class, a visiting high counselor informed the stake president, who instructed the bishop to release Garth. The bishop said he would fast and pray as he considered the stake president's advice. After doing so, he reported that he felt his initial inspiration in calling Garth was still valid and declined to release him. "This bishop is not a liberal man," observed Garth. "He's a righteous man." We need more such models of nurturing leaders. And seventh, as a community, we must seek humility as a prerequisite for a more loving, less fearful community. The Apostle Paul queried, "Am I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth?" Oliver Cromwell pleaded, "I beseech you in the bowels of Christ, think it possible you may be mistaken." These are questions we must ask ourselves as well as posing them for others. My prayers for the church's ecclesiastical officers have never been more sincere than during the past few months, even when my sorrow and anguish have been most intense. I consider myself to be simultaneously a loyal Latter-day Saint, an intellectual, and a feminist. Let me add that I'm also a supporter of Equal Ecclesiast. Will someone turn off that cell phone, please? Thank you. A supporter of equal ecclesiastical rights for gays and lesbians, my identity involves all four elements. I cannot truncate my life by excising one or more elements in a misguided search for simplicity. Kathy Stokes changed my life forever by saying, "When I went to the temple, I consecrated all of me. That included my blackness. If the Lord can use it, it's His." She set me on the road to realizing that the Lord wanted all of me, even the parts that the church did not want and could not use. With the utmost reverence, I declare that I have tried to make a full consecration. Consequently, as I hope for forgiveness, so must I offer it, and I do. We must mutually acknowledge our pain, whether intentionally or unintentionally inflicted. We must ask for and offer forgiveness. We must affirm the goals of charity, integrity, loyalty, and honesty that are foundational in the gospel. And someday, may we move beyond forgiveness of the humanness in our revealed religion to celebrate being a community knit together in joy and love. Thank you.
You can imagine that's a tough act to follow. I'm both touched and flattered by Levina's invitation to respond to her heartfelt concerns about the church and its scholars. Levina is among the people whom I most love and respect on the earth. But she knows that I do not find her chronology of ecclesiastical abuse stories to be either entirely fair or balanced. Her 20-year chronology, published in 1993, was as much an essay in investigative reporting as it was in scholarly assessment. While it does record a few neutral and mundane developments, it is largely a selective record of unhappy encounters between her friends and certain church leaders, general and local. She defines her chronology for us at the outset as accounts of survivors of ecclesiastical abuse, lest we are tempted to entertain other interpretations for some of those encounters. Many of the encounters themselves are selectively detailed, if only because Levina was not able to get enough relevant facts from the key parties involved. While conceding that some of these counts might therefore be, quote-unquote, lopsided, she feels justified in writing about them anyway, just because, quote, there is no way at this stage to make allowances, unquote, for the varied versions that different key parties might have of these encounters. Of course, one way might have been to wait for a later stage with more information. Indeed, it happened that in one of the cases to which her chronology gave some prominence, I was personally acquainted with a number of facts that would have shed quite a different light on the case. I could not help wondering how many other cases suffered from selective presentation. It was a little like bringing home a sack of sour lemons from the citrus section of the grocery store without having noticed any sweet oranges in the bins. Not that there would be any difficulty in finding sour lemons. I have lived long enough to have tasted a great many lemons in the church myself, and perhaps even to have served some. If I had kept track, I could perhaps match Levina's account lemon for lemon. But why should we be surprised at all the lemons? The Lord Himself is quoted as warning that almost all of us have a tendency to exercise unrighteous dominion. This could be as true of some feminists and intellectuals among us as of some of our leaders. Yet I have never found the public and strident outrage over this tendency to be very constructive or even to promote healing. It seems to me somewhat comparable to sharing family scandals in public. Of course, if a crime has been committed, the perpetrator should be exposed to the authorities fully and quickly, family member or not. But family problems will not necessarily be solved by airing them in public, and certainly those responsible cannot be expected to respond positively to public embarrassment. Thus, when my friends have felt mistreated in the church, I have preferred to offer private counsel and such comfort as I can, rather than join in public recriminations, especially where I have lacked adequate information about specifics. It is not my place to tell Levina or anyone else how to respond to their treatment in the church, but my preference is to step back from the trees of my own feelings and experiences, try for a more detached view of the forest. From such a perspective, I have elsewhere analyzed and attempted to explain the more general historical context of these developments, namely the transformation in LDS culture and governance during the second half of the 20th century. That's the theme of my book, Angel and Beehive. Much of that transformation has certainly been as disquieting to me as it has been to Levina. However, rather than give vent to anger in public denunciations of church policies or leaders, I have found it helpful to keep in mind certain basic ways of understanding the church as an institution, and I would like to share a few of these with you in case they might be helpful to you. First, I try to keep in mind that the church makes no claim to being a democratic institution. In the quaint imagery of our 19th century discourse, it is often called a kingdom. As I read history, early Utah was, indeed, much more like a kingdom than it is now. And I suspect that those chafing in today's church under centralized control, male domination, and internal espionage might benefit by a comparative perspective. Yet, even an attenuated kingdom is not a democracy. So I have never been surprised, as apparently Levina has, by, quote, violations of my American sense of fair play and expectation of due process, to say nothing of, quote, unquote, academic ideals. When I hear injunctions such as follow the prophet, or when the leaders have spoken, the thinking has been done, I'm sometimes irritated by the imperious style and rhetoric, but the substance is not very different from what corporate management might say when they call on their staff to get with the program. Corporations can be run as democratic cooperatives, but most are not. Some Protestant churches are more or less democratic, but not all. The LDS Church is not a democracy, so why should anyone expect it to operate as though it were? It is, however, a fully voluntary organization. And if the time ever comes when I feel that it has lost its divine mandate or that its policies and teachings do more harm than good, I will simply walk quietly away. I do not discount any of the harm that Levina has reviewed, either today or in her earlier presentations. But I am not so sure that all the blame lies with church leaders, and I still find far more good than harm in LDS church life. Second observation. I've learned that social groups, especially large bureaucratic organizations, whether kingdoms or democracies, operate by supra-individual processes and imperatives. At the individual level, members and leaders might do the best they can with the information and perspectives available to them. Many individual bureaucrats even have altruistic intentions, but as often as not, they are guided by self-interest, so well expressed in the dictum, CYOB, cover your own behind. Organizational processes can rarely be controlled fully by individual leaders or bureaucrats, whatever their intentions. One of the processes beyond individual control is sometimes called the law of unintended consequences. There are many examples of this in both the 19th and 20th century. To take some 20th century examples, and time only permits one, really. When the so-called correlation program was seriously implemented back in the 1960s, it seems unlikely to me that one of the calculated intentions was a crackdown on women and blacks. Yet the Relief Society in primary, along with other auxiliaries, lost the autonomy that they had once enjoyed, and the few black Boy Scouts in the church were automatically ineligible for troop leadership positions without the priesthood. Conspiracy theorists might see a pernicious motivation of sexism and racism behind all this. I find it simpler and probably more realistic to see these developments as unintended consequences, which church leaders have sometimes attempted to mitigate without reversing the correlation program itself. We know that the Lord moves in mysterious ways, and never more so than when he works through bureaucracies. We often have to take a very long view to see the divine hand, and I can understand why some are not willing to wait. When Orthodox Latter-day Saints bear testimony that the church is led by prophets, they rarely give any thought to the mixture of the human and the divine that underlie these organizational processes. It has been a long time since any LDS prophet has claimed to enjoy direct revelation through personal conversations with the Lord. Unless we are naive enough to think that our prophets obtain revelation primarily through these personal conversations, we must fall back on what the Scriptures say about the revelatory process in passages like the ninth section of the Doctrine and Covenants and Moroni chapter 10. These passages make clear to me that revelation begins with human initiative and that divine confirmation is always problematic, because it has to break through a variety of cultural and psychological preconceptions. My study of LDS history convinces me that although the kingdom has a divine origin, it has been left by the Lord in feeble human hands, which sometimes do and sometimes do not reach out adequately for divine guidance in given cases. I do not complain about these human hands, since mine have been among them, and I know how difficult it is to disentangle my will from the divine will. In such a system, yes, of course, our leaders often make mistakes and commit sins, sometimes serious ones, with many unintended consequences. I try to follow the leaders anyway, not out of blind obedience or belief in their infallibility, but out of appreciation for the gravity of their responsibilities and the organizational complexities and cross-pressures within which they work. As a young man, I passed through that long process of disillusionment common to those who begin with a rosy view of church history and hold unattainably high expectations for church leaders. In later years, I have immunized myself against disillusionment by adopting very low expectations. So I am rarely disappointed. In some instances where I think leaders have been mistaken, or where their counsel did not seem relevant to my particular needs and circumstances, I have sought my own divine guidance directly and have received it. On such grounds, I have sometimes declined to participate personally in a policy or program that did not seem right to me. Yet, no matter how certain I have felt about my own position, I have never considered my personal guidance as license to lead or support a public challenge to the legitimacy of the church leadership or to the policies and doctrines they have collectively and officially promulgated. I have felt free to write and speak publicly with my analyses of the origins and likely consequences of certain doctrines and policies, both historical and contemporary. But I have tried to do so with impersonal detachment and balance, without animus, and without attributing ulterior motives, even when I feel angry. While this posture has not resulted in any formal church discipline for me, it has resulted in interviews with two different stake presidents and one prominent general authority. I do not know on whose initiative ultimately these interviews were called for, but in all cases, I found them enjoyable and reassuring, conducted with mutual respect and goodwill. I have never been obsequious, I have never been threatened, and I have remained active in the church. I am not surprised, however, that I have never been called as a bishop or a stake president either. Which matters not a whit to me, for it only leaves me freer to speak and write as I please. I know that others have had very different outcomes in their interviews with leaders, and I make no attempt to account for those differences, though I might have my suspicions. In my own interviews, I have always been prepared for further discipline, even for the extremity of excommunication. I have tried to take to each interview an open mind about my own possible failings and misunderstandings. I have tried also to cultivate a close enough personal relationship with the divine that if I were to be excommunicated or unfairly treated for my commitments of conscience, I could depart in the assurance that an injustice by church leaders would simply not be ratified in the heavens and would eventually be overturned. To the extent that I have that divine assurance, I do not fear any church discipline, and I cannot be intimidated. Yet, at the same time, I would do all I could to convey this same assurance to my own family, as well as to other members of the church, so that those close to me need not be demoralized by whatever happens to me. Levina, to her enormous credit, seems to have adopted this policy in large part toward her own family, which I'm sure is the main reason that her son is a returned missionary preparing for temple marriage. Third point, almost true. The human element shows itself not only in normal organizational processes and unintended consequences within the church, but also in the comings and goings of human influences from outside the church. I speak here of more than the obvious local syncretic borrowings that all world religions have had to deal with. We in North America tend to forget that our local culture also gets imported into our religion in important respects. Many a feature of church programs and history reflect the influences of outside trends and movements. These include the Word of Wisdom, the Relief Society, the Boy Scouts, professionalized social welfare, racism, conservative politics, and corporate methods of governance, Victorian domestic traditions, feminism, and many other examples. We might be glad about some of these outside imports, but not so glad about others. The point is, they all bespeak a strong susceptibility for church programs, teachings, leaders, and members to be influenced by trends in American society. Feminism presents an interesting paradox here. It was tolerated, if not supported, by 19th century church leaders, perhaps in the belief that it would neutralize some of the outrage about polygamy among progressive Americans, especially American women. In the 20th century, however, the church leaders have opposed feminism in the apparent belief that it undermines an American family already in trouble. Feminism and Victorian domesticity, racism and then racial egalitarianism, all have made themselves felt in Mormonism. We seem pretty sure, in retrospect, that some of these influences have had divine sanction, but our ancestors felt the same way about other influences. All these influences come from the surrounding social world, and we privilege them selectively, depending upon our own generation, our own backgrounds, and our own interests. Our church leaders do the same. I have not attempted to take up one by one Levina's charges about various kinds of ecclesiastical abuse, another term borrowed from the outside. I will say only that lumping all these accounts together under the same label obscures many differences among individual cases. Even the celebrated cases of the September 6th, later augmented to 9 or 10 or 11 or 12, were not all the same. Though, from what I know, I do not think excommunication was appropriate for any of them. Nor is orthodoxy versus academic freedom the sole issue every time an outspoken scholar is denied tenure at BYU. Indeed, anyone who has had a career in secular academia, as I have, has had to deal regularly with the orthodoxy of political correctness in our public universities. As church members, even intellectual church members, we risk doing serious injustice ourselves each time we assume that we know all the facts of a case well enough to make charges or point fingers. Now and then, Levina acknowledges this limitation and calls for us to seek humility. Yet she also resorts at times to the implicit or explicit attribution of ulterior motives, or to rhetorical put-downs like follow the prophet drum roll or orthodoxy vigilantes, or to sweeping generalizations about, for example, the handling of child sexual abuse in the church, which is a very complicated problem, and very much complicated by the onslaught of the McMartin day school scandal and a lot of other things. So there's a lot more to many of these things than might originally meet the eye. Please do not misunderstand my message here. Anyone who has read my assessments of recent church history will know that I do not welcome the retrenchment motif that has increasingly characterized church governance since World War II. It has produced a church far less comfortable for me than the one of my youth. Yet I take a cyclical view of such developments, and I see signs already of an attenuation in this retrenchment, recognizing that major social trends and movements take a long time to work themselves out. Meanwhile, the placing of blame and assignment of motives for such developments, whether in large bureaucracies, in nation states, or in the business cycle, greatly oversimplify social reality without enhancing our understanding of it. At the individual level, we might very well see cases of malfeasance, misfeasance, or unrighteous dominion, but even then, justly assigning blame is a complicated business. Furthermore, church leaders are rarely, if ever, influenced by public criticism from the inside, however sensitive they might be to external pressures. If, with all its failings, this is still the Lord's kingdom and not just another worldly enterprise, I would rather see us focus on damage control rather than on whistleblowing. Let us, by all means, speak up candidly to our leaders, local and general, but let us do so in love and temperance and away from the din and glare of public scandal-mongering, just as we would try to do in our own families. Thank you.
Thank you, Levina and Armin, for your presentations. We have about 10 minutes for questions, and what we want to do, because we're so brief in time, please state a brief question into the microphone directly if you'd like to come up. And I know we'll take you towards the front, but we'd like you to repeat, to state your question into the microphone yourself.
It's just short. I almost feel that Levina ought to have a chance to respond.
Yes.
But what I would like to do, to word this like a question, Levina, would you tell us why it is that you decided you had to go?
Anne wanted to know why it was I felt that we needed to go public with the case reports. Let me just make three comments. I ask Armand to respond to this paper because I hope that he would provide not only a balancing voice to mine, but a larger context in which to analyze these issues. That's exactly what he's done, and I hope that we have provided a textbook example of balance for a Sunstone session. The second thing I want to say is that I'm really uncomfortable with Armin's well-intentioned compliment that somehow I did something right to get Christian on his mission, because the implication of that is that Christian did not make his own decisions, he certainly did, and B, that all the other parents did something wrong, and I absolutely reject that. The dynamics in the other families that have experienced excommunication, we have just been protected from a lot of that. And third, when Armin has a chance to respond, I was very intrigued by the story he almost told about finding himself troubled by some policy, seeking personal revelation, and then making a decision of quiet noncompliance. And if you felt comfortable, Armand, I would certainly like you to talk about that a little more. I think that that might be a model that would help people who are exploring other options for themselves. In terms of why the Mormon Alliance felt that it was important to publish the case reports, there are two reasons. One is that what we found as we worked with survivors of ecclesiastical abuse was an enormous amount of pain and confusion, because they were dealing with two realities. One was the reality of the church as a beneficent family, supportive, loving, and always right, and then their very real experience that said, what has happened is wrong. Some people had been trapped in trying to make these two conflicting realities harmonize for years. There was one woman I talked to who had spent over 30 years going over and over and over the same facts because she couldn't make them, she couldn't reconcile them. And telling her story, for some reason, and people who deal with counseling, people who deal with biography, may understand this dynamic better than I do. But telling her story from beginning to end, seeing cause and effect and chronology, made sense of it for a way that she hadn't been able to do inside her head for 30 years. That's one reason, that there's a kind of clarity and closure that comes with constructing your story that brings sense to it. The second reason is that there's an enormously healing service component to sharing stories of abuse, and sexual abuse survivors know this especially, that when you are able to tell your story in a way that helps someone else who has been experiencing something similar but who thought they were the only one, is enormously liberating, because it means you have something to give back. And that has been the case in all of the experiences that we've had with publication. I thought we would get a lot of wackos. I thought we would get a lot of fanatics. I thought we would get a lot of people who were, frankly, out to lunch. I found people who had worked very, very hard on making sense of their experience, who had worked very hard on the emotional component of coming to terms with what had happened to them, not obsessing about it, but of finding ways of getting on with their lives. And I have been honored by what I have learned from and the association I have had with ecclesiastical abuse survivors.
I'd like to ask Armand how his idea of solving these problems in-house differs from a family dynamic where the father, say, beats the children senseless and the mother does damage control by bandaging them up afterwards but keeping it quiet from the public. I'd also like to ask Levina if we can expect Volume 4 of Case Reports.
I'm not sure everybody picked up on it, but one of the passages I tried to emphasize in my presentation was that when we're talking about crimes that have been committed, then we need to go to the police. And when you talk about beating a kid senseless, you're talking about a crime. There are all sorts of other kinds of parental misconduct that we might see going on in other families, or we might see in our own family. And I think it's up in the family setting, it's up to each of us to make a decision about where we want to go with that knowledge. It depends on the kind of relationship we're concerned about. It depends upon the kind of behavior that is going on that we find objectionable. There may not be, in some cases, anything you can do but go to some other agency, some kind of helping profession to do it. My only point was that it rarely does the family any good to put it in the newspaper.
I'd like both of you to comment on a thought that I had. As I've gotten involved in Sunstone and began working for Sunstone, the thing that has pained me the most and deeply troubled me is the assumption on both sides of the aisle, as they say in politics, that the other side has dubious motives. And I promise you that it is not just whatever you want to label them, the conservatives, the non-Sunstoners, the brethren. I have seen it on both sides, and it really troubles me, and I'd like to know, as silly as it may sound, why can't we all just get along? Why can't we assume that, yes, perhaps we have a problem with this, but the other person is trying to do their best? I recently corresponded with someone who is critical of Sunstone, and he just could not believe that we would meet for good purposes and for good reasons. And I found that many people involved with Sunstone do the same thing, and I'd like you both to comment on that, and if there's a way to correct that.
Yes, I think there is a way to correct it. I think that we have to begin with the humility of saying we have two realities in conflict here. Are parts of both of them wrong? Is mine wrong and the other one right? But the other part of it is there has to be a willingness to communicate. I think one of the most disheartening pieces of my work with the Mormon Alliance was that the trustees spent an entire year very carefully drafting a letter to the First Presidency, outlining in as judicious and non-threatening a way as I think, well, as we were capable of doing, what we saw some of the issues were and asking for a meeting. And that request was rejected not once but twice. And if people won't talk, how can understanding be built? And I think that a lot of dialogue takes place between the church and its various sub-communities takes place in the newspapers because there's no other forum for it. And I really wish that there were other ways of meeting besides, just one or two.
Well, if John means why can't we all get along and is referring to different viewpoints or interest groups or camps or whatever in the scholarly community, my response is I think we are getting along. That's what this gathering is all about. We have an ongoing conversation, and I hope it keeps going. So as far as getting along is concerned, among those who care enough to participate in enterprises like Sunstone and Dialogue, then I think the way to get along is to continue the conversation in respect and in goodwill, which is what I feel here in this room today. If we're talking about getting along with the brethren, all I can do is refer you back to the model of governance in the church, which the church leaders have always assumed and which they expect the members to assume. And in that model of governance, you don't contact the brethren with well-meaning proposals originating from the grassroots in the expectation that they're going to take it seriously. They expect Latter-day Saints to know better than to do that. Now, you might find that imperious, and I find it imperious, but I know that's the way the church works. And so I live with that as long as I'm a member of the church. And I do think, and I have learned from considerable personal experience, that it is efficacious to form private relationships with church leaders at the local and general level, and to remonstrate with them as individuals. And I know that change occurs through those kinds of remonstrances. Not rapid change, but change does occur. The point is that if change is going to occur that in any way originates from the grassroots, it's going to occur through those kinds of channels and not through public criticism or public questioning of church policies that gets in the newspapers. I'm just telling you as a practical matter, whatever may be the philosophical objections that you may have to the one view or the other, telling you as an empirical, practical matter that it simply doesn't work. And so we have to find a different way for that kind of communication.
Okay, I'm sorry, we're out of time now. Thank you all for coming. Thanks especially to Levina and Armin.